elevated sound, the yee. As the sound source passes, the sound waves spread out and lengthen, causing the pitch to drop abruptly. The yum. Cypher was the first to notice this effect with light and to realize its potential importance for understanding the motions of the cosmos. Unfortunately, no one much noticed him. The Lowell Observatory, as you will recall, was a bit of an oddity, thanks to Percival Lowell's obsession with Martian canals, which in the 1910s made it, in every sense, an outpost of astronomical endeavor. Cypher was unaware of Einstein's theory of relativity, and the world was equally unaware of Cypher, so his finding had no impact. Glory, instead, would pass to a large mass of ego named Edwin Hubble. Hubble was born in 1889, 10 years after Einstein, in a small Missouri town on the edge of the Ozarks, and grew up there and in Wheaton, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. His father was a successful insurance executive, so life was always comfortable, and Edwin enjoyed a wealth of physical endowments, too. He was a strong and gifted athlete, charming, smart, and immensely good-looking, handsome almost to a fault in the description of William H. Cropper. An Adonis, in the words of another admirer. According to his own accounts, he also managed to fit into his life more or less constant acts of valor, rescuing drowning swimmers, leading frightened men to safety across the battlefields of France, embarrassing world champion boxers with knockdown punches in exhibition bouts. It all seemed too good to be true. It was. For all his gifts, Hubble was also an inveterate liar. This was more than a little odd, for Hubble's life was filled from an early age with a level of distinction that was at times almost ludicrously golden. At a single high school track meet in 1906, he won the pole vault, shot put, discus, hammer throw, standing high jump, and running high jump, and was on the winning mile relay team, that is, 7 first places in one meet, and came in third in the broad jump. In the same year, he set a state record for the high jump in Illinois. As a scholar, he was equally proficient and had no trouble gaining admission to study physics and astronomy at the University of Chicago, where, coincidentally, the head of the department was now Albert Michelson. There, he was selected to be one of the first Rhodes Scholars at Oxford. 3 years of English life evidently turned his head, for he returned to Wheaton in 1913, wearing an Inverness cape, smoking a pipe, and talking with a peculiarly orotund accent, not quite British, but not quite not, that would remain with him for life. Though he later claimed to have passed most of the second decade of the century practicing law in Kentucky, in fact he worked as a high school teacher and basketball coach in New Albany, Indiana, before belatedly attaining his doctorate and passing briefly through the army. He arrived in France 1 month before the armistice and almost certainly never heard a shot fired in anger. In 1919, now aged 30, he moved to California and took up a position at the Mount Wilson Observatory near Los Angeles. Swiftly, and more than a little unexpectedly, he became the most outstanding astronomer of the 20th century. It is worth pausing for a moment to consider just how little was known of the cosmos at this time. Astronomers today believe there are perhaps 140 billion galaxies in the visible universe. That's a huge number. Much bigger than merely saying it would lead you to suppose. If galaxies were frozen peas, it would be enough to fill a large auditorium, the old Boston Garden, say, or the Royal Albert Hall. An astrophysicist named Bruce Gregory has actually computed this. In 1919, when Hubble first put his head to the eyepiece, the number of these galaxies that were known to us was exactly one, the Milky Way. Everything else was thought to be either part of the Milky Way itself or one of many distant peripheral puffs of gas. Hubble quickly demonstrated how wrong that belief was. Over the next decade, Hubble tackled two of the most fundamental questions of the universe: how old is it and how big? To answer both, it is necessary to know two things: how far away certain galaxies are and how fast they are flying away from us, what is known as their recessional velocity. The redshift gives the speed at which galaxies are retiring, but doesn't tell us how far away they are to begin with. For that, you need what are known as standard candles, stars whose brightness can be reliably calculated and used as benchmarks to measure the brightness, and hence relative distance, of other stars. Hubble's luck was to come along soon after an ingenious woman named Henrietta Swan Leavitt had figured out a way to do so. Leavitt worked at the Harvard College Observatory as a computer, as they were known. Computers spent their lives studying photographic plates of stars and making computations, hence the name. It was little more than drudgery by another name, but it was as close as women could get to real astronomy at Harvard, or indeed pretty much anywhere in those days. The system, however unfair, did have certain unexpected benefits. It meant that half the finest minds available were directed to work that would otherwise have attracted little reflective attention, and it ensured that women ended up with an appreciation of the fine structure of the cosmos that often eluded their male counterparts. One Harvard computer, Annie Jump Cannon, used her repetitive acquaintance with the stars to devise a system of stellar classifications so practical that it is still in use today. Leavitt's contribution was even more profound. She noticed that a type of star known as a Cepheid variable, after the constellation Cepheus, where it first was identified, pulsated with a regular rhythm, a kind of stellar heartbeat. Cepheids are quite rare, but at least one of them is well known to us. Polaris, the pole star, is a Cepheid. We now know that Cepheids throb as they do because they are elderly stars that have moved past their main sequence phase, in the parlance of astronomers, and become red giants. The chemistry of red giants is a little weighty for our purposes here. It requires an appreciation for the properties of singly ionized helium atoms, among quite a lot else, but put simply, it means that they burn their remaining fuel in a way that produces a very rhythmic, very reliable brightening and dimming. Leavitt's genius was to realize that by comparing the relative magnitudes of Cepheids at different points in the sky, you could work out where they were in relation to each other. They could be used as standard candles, a term she coined and still in universal use. The method provided only relative distances, not absolute distances, but even so, it was the first time that anyone had come up with a usable way to measure the large-scale universe. Just to put these insights into perspective, it is perhaps worth noting that at the time Leavitt and Cannon were inferring fundamental properties of the cosmos from dim smudges on photographic plates, the Harvard astronomer William H. Pickering, who could of course peer into a first-class telescope as often as he wanted, was developing his seminal theory that dark patches on the moon were caused by swarms of seasonally migrating insects.